Well, we're in that passage I read a moment ago, Mark chapter 13 and verses 1 to 23. And as I've said already, it is a challenging passage, and I just really want to get into the meat of it as quickly as possible. And so my only introduction really is to say that I have 2 points, and those 2 points will look at 2 dimensions of the person of Jesus Christ as he's presented to us in this passage. I want us to consider 2 roles, 2 aspects of Jesus Christ presented to us in this passage. And firstly then, Jesus is a prophet. Jesus is a prophet. He stands at the end of a long line of Old Testament prophets. We mentioned that fact a little while ago when we looked at the parable of the vineyard back in chapter 11 of this gospel, how the servants are sent to that vineyard and Jesus is the final servant, and those servants really represent the Old Testament prophets who were sent to Israel, and Jesus then, he stands at the end of that long line of prophets. And part of what it meant to be a prophet was declaring God's plans for the future. It's probably the thing which pops into our head most instinctively when we think of the role of a prophet. And that's what Jesus does here. In chapter 13, what is often called the Olivet Discourse, it takes place on the Mount of Olives. Jesus reveals God's plans for the future. He prophesies. And this evening, then, I want to just discuss, first of all, the nature of this prophecy which is presented before us. Now, let me just begin by saying that over the last few years, we've heard several other sermons on this Olivet Discourse from Matthew's Gospel. Dan's preached through Matthew's Gospel, and Alan Thomas has also preached through this discourse. And in both those sermons then, Alan and Dan interpreted this passage in a particular way. In short, the view which they took was this, that the events which Jesus is prophesying about here, at least up to verse 32 in Mark's Gospel, are not to do with the very end of history, but rather are to do with events which take place within the first century. Specifically, Jesus is talking here about events leading up to and including the Roman conquest of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in AD 70. And to be honest, at the time, I wasn't quite sure what to make of that view. But since then, I've been able to preach through 12 whole chapters of Mark's Gospel. I've been able to think about it a bit more, think about the trajectory of this book, think about the themes which we find within it. And having done that, I have to say that without being paid to say it, I have come to agree with that view on the Olivet Discourse. This is a chapter which is principally about the Roman conquest of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple in AD 70. Even when we reach the part of the passage which is just outside of our reading this evening, verses 24 to 27, that passage which mentions signs happening in the cosmos, the moon not giving its light, the stars falling out of the sky, mentions that the Son of Man coming with great power and glory, sending out his angels, gathering in the elect on the four winds. Even that part of this passage, I think, is principally about the destruction of the temple. Although, admittedly, it is a bit more complicated, and I want to save it for next time for that reason. But for now, I just want to mention a couple of things, a couple of reasons for why I take that view, and the very basic reasons, really. Firstly, just remember the immediate context of Jesus' prophecy here. So in verse 3 of chapter 13, Jesus is with his disciples, and he's being asked a question. And the question which he is being asked is, when will these things be? Now remember, he's sitting now on the Mount of Olives and he's got the temple in view. When will these things be? Ask the disciples in verse 4. Well, what things are they referring to? Well, we only have to look back up to verses 1 and 2 to see that Jesus has just mentioned that these wonderful stones in the temple will all be thrown down. So that's what these disciples are asking about. When will that happen? When will these things be? It's about the destruction of the temple. But then secondly, just remember the broader context of everything that we've been discussing in Mark's Gospel. This whole portion of Mark's Gospel has focused on the role of the temple. Right back in chapter 11, Jesus enters Jerusalem for the first time and he makes a beeline for the temple. And then he curses that fruitless fig tree. And what's he doing there? Well, it's a symbol, isn't it, of the fruitless temple order. And Jesus is putting a curse on it and the tree withers. And it's a foreshadowing of what's going to happen to the temple. And he preaches in the temple and he turns over the tables in the temple. And then he spends a chapter and a bit debating with all of the various religious orders in the temple and in that part of Jerusalem, the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And then at one point in chapter 12, he claims to be a cornerstone of what? Well, the way I interpreted it last, when I considered that passage, was the cornerstone of a new temple. So in other words then, this whole section of Mark's Gospel is about the end of one temple and the beginning of another temple. And that's the theme which now carries over into chapter 13. Jesus is now being asked, when will this happen? When will what happen? When will this old temple, this old order, this old kingdom come to an end? And when will this new temple, this new order, this new kingdom be established? And admittedly, these disciples then, they are asking a very complicated question. They can hardly have realized just how big a scale of a question these disciples really were asking. But again, I just want us to see that these first 23 verses of this passage deal with this issue, which is surely on their minds, the disciples' minds. These verses deal with the events which lead up to the destruction of the old Jerusalem temple. And so I suppose then that the simplest thing to do initially in this sermon is just spell out the history which Jesus, as a prophet, is now foretelling. Jesus is telling these disciples, in response to their question, that before this temple crumbles, this old temple, several things are going to take place in history. Let's look at those predictions. Verse 6, he mentions false messiahs. And we know from history that that is a correct prediction. The Jewish historian Josephus mentions various people in this period who claimed to be prophets or kings rising up. He talks about a false prophet called Theudas. He talks about an Egyptian magician. He talks about various other deceivers. Jesus goes on to talk about wars and rumors of wars in verses 7 to 8. And again, that is a correct prediction. There would have been talk of wars taking place in that period of history, wars going on over in Parthia. Also, Herod, King Herod, found himself at war with the Nabataeans in the south, which the Romans get involved with. And then, of course, there would have been various local uprisings taking place, little sort of civil wars taking place following the death of Nero. And then Jesus mentions in verse 8 earthquakes and famines. And again, we know just from the Bible itself that that's a correct prediction. We remember the earthquake which takes place in Philippi in Acts chapter 16. But there was also another earthquake in Jerusalem itself in AD 67. And then in Phrygia and Pompeii. And then Luke tells us in Acts about a famine during the reign of Claudius. So, correct prediction. Then we have persecution in verse 9, and of course we don't need to say very much about that. That sentence, that second sentence in verse 9 really just summarizes the whole book of Acts, doesn't it? And then we have in verse 10, Jesus talking about the spread of the gospel. That's what he says has to happen before the temple comes to an end. And that is particularly important, isn't it? Because that is, to our eyes, a very big promise he makes there. The gospel must first be proclaimed to all nations. And you might think, well, surely that's not fulfilled by AD 70. That's a huge promise. We have to wait to the end of the age before that takes place. But I actually think that we really mustn't underplay just how dramatic the change which takes place in history with respect to the preaching of the gospel from the point of Pentecost onwards. I mean, think about it. We talked recently at a midweek about the temple in Jerusalem and Solomon's prayer at the dedication of that temple. And Solomon prays then about foreigners who have heard about the greatness of God and are drawn to that temple. And for thousands of years, there's a tiny trickle of people who come from the other nations towards that temple in Jerusalem. But then, you see, in a flash, everything changes at Pentecost. And the God of that temple now goes out to meet the nations. And within just a couple of decades, there are thousands of worshippers in Greece and in Turkey and in Rome and in Spain and probably as far north as Britain and as far east as India. That's a huge event to take place. I think that's what Jesus is talking about here. The gospel being preached to all the nations. All of that takes place before AD 70. And then he goes on in verse 12 to prophesy about division, probably division between believers, not necessarily literal brothers and parents and children, but quite possibly Christian relations as well, brothers and parents and children. And of course, we know for a fact that, although it's difficult for us to really think about, the Romans put pressure on people to betray other Christians, Christians to betray their fellow brothers, and they were successful in doing that. And then in verse 14, we arrive at this notorious prediction, the abomination of desolation, as Jesus describes it. It's probably the most difficult thing we have in our passage, and I want to come back to it a little bit later on. There are a few contenders for what this refers to. Probably it's something which is defiling the Jewish temple. It might be the Roman armies themselves entering the temple. It might be the flags which they set up in the temple courts, the idolatrous flags which people then made offerings to. It might have been the Roman commander Titus himself entering the temple. It might have been an earlier proposal to erect a statue of Emperor Caligula in the temple, though that never actually went ahead and it happened quite a bit earlier. But whatever it was then, this is an awful event. It's some kind of desecration of the temple. And it meant then that it was time to flee Jerusalem. And then in verses 18 and 19, we have this mention of tribulation, which is worse than has ever been, Jesus says. Whether we take those words literally or not, you have to admit that the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, the sacking of Jerusalem, was unthinkably appalling. It was a ruthless massacre which took place. Josephus reckons more than 1 million people were killed, murder, famine, cannibalism during the siege. It was absolutely harrowing. It was earth-shatteringly bad, which is why I think the cosmic imagery of the next portion of the text is actually totally appropriate. And then finally, he comes back to these false messiahs in verses 21 and 22. And we mentioned earlier a few candidates for who those could be. But you can imagine then how people in the wake of that horrible destruction of Jerusalem would be particularly susceptible at that point to being misled to all kinds of devious people. And so then that's in brief the prediction Jesus makes in our passage. And Jesus says then that before the temple is destroyed, all of that has to happen. And no doubt that was quite a lot for Peter and for James and John and Andrew to have to take in. That all of this was just on their doorstep. Jesus tells us in verse 30 that this will be happening in the space of a generation. That probably seemed impossible for them to compute. Just too much to take in. But that's Jesus' prophecy. And history tells us that that prophecy was not said in vain. So Jesus is a prophet. He comes with the authority and more of an Old Testament prophet. And those Old Testament prophets could be very severe people, couldn't they? Their purpose was very often to go to a nation, to go to Jerusalem, to go to a people who were in the midst of their frivolities, their immorality, their complacencies, and to throw a big bucket of water over that people and to warn them of judgment, to wake up the sleepers, to sober the drunk. Listen to the words of Jeremiah prophesying the Babylonian captivity in Jeremiah 25. He says, because you have, this is the Lord speaking, because you have not obeyed my words, behold, I will send for Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants. I will devote them to destruction and make them a horror, a hissing, and an everlasting desolation. I will banish from them the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the grinding of the millstone and the light of the lamp. This whole land shall become a ruin and a waste. It's haunting words from Jeremiah. It takes the wind right out of you. It rocks you to the core. Well, these are the words of an Old Testament prophet, warning of judgment. But you see, in this passage, Jesus, the prophet, speaks like that. In fact, he goes further than that. He speaks of a worse fate for Israel than the Babylonian invasion. He speaks of the final destruction of the Jerusalem temple. He speaks of the loss of the capital, the worst event to take place in the history of Israel, the curtains finally falling on the end of this era. That's Jesus' prophetic proclamation. He is, in this passage, a prophet, a preacher of doom. He's throwing that icy bucket all over the city of Jerusalem, waking them up to the judgment which is to come. Okay, so where does that leave us this evening? I mean, if these words are simply applicable to the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70 and nothing more, then what do we do with this passage? How can this possibly be relevant to us? Well, perhaps I'll say this. Biblical prophecy is a difficult thing. It gives us a window onto God's plan for history, but not always in the kind of way that we want. Often we find that what it does say about a particular historical moment has a kind of recurring significance which sort of unfolds as history progresses, a sort of recurring relevance of the prophet's words of judgment on history. That perhaps doesn't sound very clear to you. Let me try to explain what I mean. It's almost as if in the prophets we find certain biblical themes and stories and patterns reverberating down through the tunnel of history and growing louder and louder and louder. I'll just give you an example of what I mean by that. So this isn't a prophet I'm speaking of here, but in the Bible we're presented with Babel back in Genesis 11, and there we see certain themes caught up in that event at Babel. But that event seems to kind of evolve through the Bible into actual Babylon in the Old Testament. Babel seems to be a kind of micro version of Babylon in the Old Testament. And then in the New Testament, we find Babylon returning again, but this time that word is now referring to the Roman Empire, to Rome. And then again, it seems to have a recurring significance even after that to speak of sort of all worldly political dominating powers extending into the future. So the point is then that Babylon is a sort of recurring truth which rattles down through history and picks up pace. And I think the same thing can be said of certain features in this passage. So for instance, the abomination of desolation that Jesus mentions, well, that's first mentioned, of course, back in the book of Daniel. And in the book of Daniel, the abomination of desolation seems to be very obviously referring to a particular act, not of a Roman ruler, but of a Greek ruler, Antiochus Epiphanes, who in the 2nd century BC sets up a statue of Zeus in the temple and sacrifices a pig on the altar. That's the original abomination of desolation. But you see, here then Jesus extends that prophecy into his own time. As we said before, it now seems to be referring to some new act of defilement by the Romans in the temple. But then again, you see, as we progress through the New Testament, we find there might even be another layer on top of that. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, we read of another event still to come, I think, at the end of history. The man of lawlessness is described there, and we're told that he will take his seat in the temple of God, proclaiming himself to be God. Yet another final abomination of desolation. I think. As if that prophecy started in Daniel kind of grows and picks up pace and heads towards the end of history. And the same goes for the tribulation, which Jesus mentions. He says this tribulation is very great. It's the greatest history has known. And again, that might be hyperbole, but it's the same kind of language that Daniel speaks of, referring to a tribulation in his day. And as we progress through the New Testament, we find hints that there will be another tribulation at the end of history to come. Now, I hope I haven't lost you at this point. I don't want to get into the details of what all of those things mean for the future. But I think we can say this, that there is a tone in this passage, a tone of solemnity, of watchfulness, of being alert, of looking out to the historical horizon, of avoiding complacency in the presence of these warnings, which carries over into our own day. Jesus is the prophet, yes, who speaks of deception coming in that first century in his own times. But the scriptures show us elsewhere that that prophecy has not yet expired fully. There will also be deceivers to come in our own times. Jesus, the prophet here, speaks of tribulation and persecution and bloodshed and betrayal in his own day. But there will also be tribulation and persecution and bloodshed and betrayal for believers in our day as well. Jesus, the prophet, speaks of a terrifying judgment on Jerusalem, but there is, of course, coming a judgment upon the world, of which that judgment on Jerusalem is only a small foretaste. And so again, then, I'm saying we have a recurring significance, a relevance of the prophecies in this passage, even into our own day. And this much is certain, then. We need to be awake. We need to be alert. We need to be made watchful by Jesus the prophet. These events which happened in this passage, which are referred to in this passage, really did happen. Those horrible events Jesus prophesied happened well and truly in that first century. Probably we don't think very much about the events of AD 70, but when you do see their significance and their size, you realize they do cast a dark shadow over the Gospels. You know, we see Jesus in the Gospels walking around the streets of Jerusalem, and it all feels very much alive and very stable. And we meet all these different people with different professions here and there, tax collectors and fishermen and merchants and beggars and soldiers, and all of those different religious groups, the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the synagogue rulers. And we see these people, and it just looks like such a stable, ordinary world to live in, just ordinary folk going about their lives. And yet little do these people know that their world is about to fall through entirely. 40 years later, those same streets of Jerusalem are covered in the blood of the people we meet in the Gospels, some of them. That same temple is reduced to rubble. Those religious divisions, who think so much of themselves, the scribes and the Pharisees and the priests, all of that terminates forever. And Jesus does what all the prophets do. He warns the people of this event severely. And we wonder then just how many people shrugged off these warnings. How many people walked past that withered fig tree without giving it a second thought? And who escaped? Well, the people who escaped were the people who heeded the prophet. The people who did flee to the hills and followed Jesus' warnings, the Christians. And so it's a simple first point this evening for you. Well, perhaps the details are not so simple, but the essence of my point is simple, that Jesus is a prophet, and we need to take him seriously. We don't want to be taken in by the deception of others. We don't want to be overtaken by tribulation or the final judgment. We don't want all of that to be a horrifying surprise to us. And what do we do then? We respond to our prophet, Jesus Christ. And we look to the future, knowing that we have been told what will happen. And so we are prepared for it. Jesus is a prophet. So that's my first point this evening. I have 2 points. And my second is this. Jesus is a pastor. Jesus is a pastor. See, when we think of the role of a prophet, I think we often think simply about the person's ability to predict the future. That's probably especially the case when we think of those sort of modernish prophets, people like Nostradamus, prophets so-called, who kind of peer into the future and make cryptic remarks about what events might take place, just because it's their special power, just because they can do that. But you see, Jesus, he's not like that, is he? He doesn't just predict the future because he can do it, just because of the fun of it. No, his speaking about the future here is based on other concerns. It's based particularly on pastoral concerns for his disciples. He tells them what's going to happen out of a pastoral heart for them. And I want now just to consider three aspects of this pastoral heart which we see in this passage. How does Jesus show pastoral concern for his disciples? Well, first of all, and this is a very general point, he addresses his listeners personally. He addresses his listeners personally. Just notice how much of this passage is in the imperative. That is, he is telling his listeners, his disciples, what they should and shouldn't do in the future. He says in verse 5, "See that no one leads you astray." It's direct at them. Verse 7, "Do not be alarmed." Verse 9, "Be on your guard." Verse 11, "Do not be anxious." The same goes for when he's talking about the inhabitants of Jerusalem. He doesn't just tell them what's going to happen in Jerusalem. He tells them what they should do about it. "Let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains," verse 14. "Let the one who is on the housetop not go down," in verse 15. If that's a slightly confusing idea of someone on a housetop not going down, probably what it means is the person is on the housetop and there's a route into the house from the top, and rather than going down back into the house and getting their belongings and coming out, rather they go down on the outside of the house, on the outer staircase, and leave that way. Verse 16, "Let the one who is in the field not turn back." And then verse 18, "Pray that it might not happen in winter." These are all imperatives directed at the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And notice now how much he is concerned with the effect of the events which are taking place on his listeners. So he doesn't just mention the fact that false teachers will come. He mentions them insofar as they are a threat to his listeners. He doesn't just mention that wars will take place. He considers them insofar as they affect his listeners, as something they hear, rumours of wars. He mentions those particular challenges which face the disciples, the immediate people listening to his teaching here. These disciples are going to be standing before councils and kings. They're going to be beaten up in the synagogues. These are not world-changing events Jesus is focusing in on at this point. They are very individual events. They are personally momentous events. That's what Jesus chooses to focus on. If we read this passage and we think to ourselves, well, why is Jesus so bothered about just a tiny slice of history taking place before AD 70, which has nothing to do with us in the present, then we need to realize it's because he wants to pastor these personal lives which are standing in front of him, people who are going to be caught up in the trauma of all this, people who are not going to just see this as a tiny slice of history, but who are going to be completely consumed by everything which is happening around them. And remember who Jesus is at this point. Jesus is a man who has predicted on several occasions his coming death, and he is now in the place of his death, and he knows it's not very long before he is going to be suffering horribly. And yet, nevertheless, Jesus could focus in and be moved by the troubles that his people are going to be facing. You know, he could have thought to himself, well, compared to what they're facing, my troubles are so much more closer and are going to be so much more worse. But ultimately, here he sympathizes with the plight of these people. He finds his heart drawn in particular to mothers with young children, to pregnant women. He imagines a scenario where it's winter and it's cold and probably the streams are filled with water and it's difficult to get out of Jerusalem. He's anticipating those events and he is grieving over them. He is touched by them. He is saddened by the expectations of what will happen. He doesn't just stand at arm's length to his prophecy. He's actually emotionally involved in his prophecy because he has a pastoral heart for the people he is speaking to. And so we see here then Jesus, he addresses his listeners personally. But then secondly, regarding Jesus the pastor, he calms their excitement. He calms their excitement. Remember what the question is, which is on the lips of Peter and James and John and Andrew at the beginning of the passage. They ask him, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign," they say, "when all these things are about to be accomplished?" So they're asking for a sign. And there's a sense then, isn't there, in which we could read this passage, and we could read it in an excitable sort of mood, couldn't we? We could use this passage to work ourselves up into an excitement, or to put ourselves or to put others in a kind of jumpy sort of mood, believing here that we have now special information about when the day of judgment is going to take place, able to pinpoint it happening. These disciples have asked for signs of the end, and now Jesus is giving them those signs. This is a passage all about the signs of the times, and now we can start looking out for these signs and guessing when the judgment is going to take place. But you see, we need to read this text a bit more carefully then. Yes, these disciples are given a sign, and we'll come on to that in a second. But until that point, I think they're actually refused signs. Here's what I mean. The disciples in verse 3 ask for their sign, but Jesus first responds by mentioning false teachers and rumours of wars. And our response to that might be, well, surely then there are signs. But notice, Jesus goes on in verse 7 to say, "And when you hear of wars and rumours of wars, do not be alarmed." That is to say, do not get frantic about the end being nigh, about happening, about being just around the corner. No, he says, this must take place, but the end is not yet. Wars, rumours of wars, are not the special sign that you're looking out for. He goes on to speak about famines and earthquakes, but again, he adds in verse 8, these are but the beginning of the birth pains. These are not special signs that we should be on the lookout for all the time. It's only when we get to verse 14 that he speaks about the abomination of desolation that Jesus, I think, is talking about the sign. But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not to be, etc., etc., then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. That's the sign, you see. The others are not, strictly speaking, signs. They are actually fairly insignificant in the grand scheme of things. So you think Jesus, he is calming the excitement of his disciples, his listeners here. He is reminding them that the world is a crazy place, and there's a danger that we get jumpy and start over-interpreting history. And the moment an earthquake takes place, we think to ourselves, well, that's it now. It's all going to happen. It's all come to an end. The moment we hear of another war taking place or entering Europe for the first time in many years, we think to ourselves, well, that's surely it now. The moment we hear of a new prophet appearing in the wilderness, as Jesus puts it, claiming to be the Christ, and we think, it's all kicking off, it's all happening now, maybe this is true. There's no time to lose, the end is nigh. But the fact is, Jesus is saying all of that is not the signs that you're looking for. Don't be alarmed. These are but the beginnings of the birth pains. Now, the fact is, if you are caught up in an earthquake or a famine, it will feel monumental in the moment. It will feel all-consuming. It will feel very significant. It will make you wonder, what does this mean? If you hear of the outbreak of a war close to home, if you hear of a familiar place or country being invaded, it will unsettle you and it will make you wonder, is it happening now? But Jesus wants us to see that we shouldn't be jumping to those conclusions. These things are not signs. Rather, they are an ordinary part of the times in which we live. They are part of a creation which is in labour, birth pains. And yes, they make us yearn for the beginning of something better. But they shouldn't terrify us and make us excitable and think to ourselves, well, the end is nigh, it's all happening. We shouldn't jump to interpreting them as signs. And so then it's a lesson for us, isn't it? The Lord may return next Tuesday. We don't know. We desire him to. But we won't learn that from an earthquake in Turkey or the war in Ukraine or a famine in Somalia. We don't get jumpy when those things happen. So, Jesus is a pastor. He addresses his listeners personally and he calms their excitement. And then thirdly, he assures them of God's love. He assures them of God's love. You see, here's the ultimate comfort, the ultimate piece of pastoral comfort given to these disciples in this passage. And it's this, that whatever happens, however history unfolds, however horrible it gets, however hard the tribulation becomes, however devious the deceivers are, whatever takes place, God will see his people through the trials which take place. How will he see his people through the trials? Well, I want to close with three further reasons how God will see his people through the trials. First of all, God will be present with them. In verse 9, it says, they will deliver you over to councils. In verse 11, it says, when they bring you and deliver you. That word deliver is the same word which is being used again and again and again in this gospel, referring to who? Referring to Christ. Christ is the one who tells us that he will be delivered to the Gentiles and crucified. And now then, the disciples have to make the connection in their heads. We are being delivered like him. It might be awful passing through that trial in the future that lies ahead, but at least we have this comfort. We are not the first people to go through it. It's a bit like when you make your way through an awkward piece of footpath covered in nettles, and your dad or your big brother or your husband walks through that patch of nettles first and sort of sets the track for you. And you then follow, and probably you'll be stung by those nettles a bit as well, but at least you'll be stung in solidarity with the person who's gone ahead of you. And I think that same principle then applies to these trials. Jesus has gone through much worse than we have. He has been delivered over to the authorities, to those who hate him. And if we are, we only do it in union with him. So God will be present with them in the trials in that respect. But secondly, God will be present in them. Jesus makes sure the disciples don't spend forever fretting about how they will represent their teacher, Jesus, in the law courts when they are handed over. No, in verse 11, he says, do not be anxious beforehand what you are going to say. Why? For it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. God will preserve his people from buckling at that moment of crisis. He will supernaturally equip them at the point when the pressure reaches its climax. At the very point when you think you might break, he is saying, I will give you my spirit and he will see you through that trial. And so then these disciples enter those trials and that tribulation and that dark future with a wonderful confidence. Not only does Jesus enter those courts before them, setting them the way to go, but also they stand in those courts themselves, filled and provided for by the same Spirit who equipped Jesus in his own trial. These men enter these courts, these synagogues, no less filled with the Spirit than Jesus himself. And so they can be no less faithful to him than he is. So God, he will be present with them in this trial. He will be present in them in this trial. And then finally, final comfort here, God will be providing for them through this trial. Verse 20 is an incredible verse when you think about it, isn't it? It reads, and if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect whom he chose, he shortened the days. He talks about no human being being saved. I think the salvation he is referring to here is final salvation. He's referring to our arrival into the presence of God at the end. Jesus is saying then that if it weren't for God sovereignly shortening the time period of this trial, then this trial would shipwreck the faith of these disciples. The trial would get so bad that it would turn these disciples into deserters of Christ, deserters of the gospel. It could jeopardize their salvation. And you hear that at first and you think, well, that sounds really, really bad. And perhaps then that makes you tremble even more at the prospect of entering trials. But then you reflect upon it and you think to yourself, well, no, actually, this is a great sign of God's love. Because what Jesus is saying here is this, that God has chosen his people. They are elect. That's a word we don't find often in the Gospels, but it's used here. He has chosen his people, and he is not letting go of them, and he will see them through to the end. In fact, even if it takes cutting short the days, squeezing history down itself into the appropriate shape, he will see them through. That's how much he desires the salvation of his chosen ones. That's how much Jesus loves his disciples. God will shape history to their abilities. And that's how much he loves us this evening. And that's how much he loves all of his children, even today. We don't know how history will unfold as we look forward to the future. As we approach the very end of history, we don't know exactly what that will look like. As we've reflected on other occasions, Scripture excites us with a great hope and great promises of the gospel going out to the ends of the world and the crop growing up, though the farmer doesn't know how, and the leaven going through the whole loaf. And we have these wonderful promises of the kingdom being established, and that fills our heart with gladness. But then on the other hand, we have prophecies in other places of tribulation, of difficulty, of apostasy, of persecution, of abominations. And perhaps then we can find ourselves so sucked into those dark prospects that we end up getting ourselves depressed and trembling, and we think to ourselves, how will we get to the end of our lives given that the world is set against us, given that Satan desires to make a shipwreck of our faith, given that things in a certain respect are going to get worse, given that there is a tribulation to come? How will we get through all of that? Well, the answer is that God will see to it that he will get you through. And whether it be by reminding you that you follow only the pathway of Jesus who went before you into the greatest of darkness, whether it's by filling you with his Holy Spirit and equipping you supernaturally, or whether it's by twisting and shaping history itself, cutting short the days to accommodate for your strength, he will do it all for you because he loves you that much. He will see you to the very end. Let that be a comfort for us all this evening. Amen.